Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Hey, this is Adam from the CRE Podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was recorded a while ago. It's a little bit dated. It's one of the conferences in 2023. It was released in video format at the time for anybody that wanted to watch Aaron and I speak in person, but this, of course, will be the podcast platform. So we are going to release all the content now. It is good stuff. Some of the references might not jibe contextually with the current market. Keep that in mind when you're listening to it. And I guess the other big takeaway message is for 2024, we've invested into a podcast producer, and you're going to see episodes that are released very shortly after recording, and you'll probably see a little more social media going on. So look forward to it.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast powered by First National. I'm Aaron Cameron. With me, of course, Adam Pawatic. Our guest this episode is Celia Chandler, the Deputy Executive Director of Cooperative Housing Federation of Toronto. Welcome, Celia. Thank you for coming on. Did I get that right?
You got it right, Aaron. Okay. Thanks
awesome.
So much.
This is great. We were just spent the last couple of minutes getting to know Celia a little bit. So I'm very excited because this is a little bit different than what we typically have as topics on this podcast, but some very topical things to discuss and some very interesting conversations. And Celia, as we're about to just explore, has a very interesting background. So let's start there, Celia. Thanks for coming on. You haven't worked at CHFT for very long. Why don't you talk about your trajectory to get to where you are today?
So I graduated in 1990 with a master's. And for those of you who were around in 1990, you'll know it was a really bad economy. So I was very lucky to get a position as a management trainee at the City of Toronto, where I spent the first 7 years of my career in the pre-amalgamated city, which was a fantastic training ground for so much of what I now do, to be honest, because I learned a ton about governance, but I also learned about municipal process and, you know, all of these things become very relevant. And then I spent some time working for an environmental NGO. And then I decided it was time to really get cracking on my career. So I went to law school. I was 35 and I went to UVic on the West Coast because, yeah, it's a really beautiful place to be. And it's also got a really great law school. And so when I graduated from there, I came back to Toronto and I took a job at a small law firm here in Toronto called Eiler Campbell. And it does a lot of work in the nonprofit sector, but really focused on housing. So nonprofit and co-op housing, which I knew nothing about. But I spent 17 years there and I was serving mostly housing co-ops, which for your listeners is a very great model of housing where people live in multi-residential settings. They do not have an equity interest, but they consider themselves owners in some ways because they're members of a corporation, a nonprofit cooperative corporation that owns the property or leases it, and they self-govern. So it's a tiny bit like a condo in that members elect their board of directors from among themselves, and then they make decisions about the management of that property. So most of what I did in that context was helping deal with the problems that arise when people live in close proximity, or as I called it, the messy human drama. And in that context, I was mostly evicting people. And after 17 years, it kind of took its toll. So I left my practice at the end of last year, and I was really lucky to land this job as the Deputy Executive Director of CHFT. It's starting in March. I'm not quite full-time, but it's been a great job that was really kind of tailor-made for me because it draws on so much of my background.
Does it feed your soul more than the previous job?
Because we lawyered in a particular way with a particular client, I didn't quite have that need for feeding my soul that you might imagine from many lawyers. But yeah, it's nice to see the positive side of co-op housing instead of just the problems. No one ever calls their lawyer to say, hey, the community's really functional today. Yeah. But they did call me a lot to tell me it was dysfunctional. So it's great to be on a looking at the same entity from a slightly different angle. It's really, really rewarding.
We are at the conference today. What was the big takeaway?
That's a really interesting question. I think for me, the takeaway was that this conference felt it was important enough to have a panel on housing affordability and how co-ops and nonprofits may be part of a broader solution to create new housing. Because obviously, it's no secret, we have an incredible shortage of affordable housing. And we also have a shortage of other kinds of housing as well. But from my point of view, the time is now. We have to start getting some housing off the ground. And I think we have an opportunity to work with our private sector friends in housing to make that happen.
CHFT, before we start recording, you mentioned 32 properties. We'll fill in the listeners. How does that stack up against, you know, other providers in the space? Like, obviously, the housing crisis is going to be 100 little pinpricks to try and deflate that balloon. How much of the market is co-op housing now? How much of a player?
Yeah, are there other co-ops in Toronto that are not members of the CHFT?
So let me explain. I want to talk about the 32 properties, Adam, but let me talk more generally about what CHFT is composed of. So in fact, we're 185 co-ops spread primarily through Toronto, but we have some in the northern municipalities of Durham and York. And we'd like to expand because there are other co-ops out there who are not yet members. There are about 50,000 people living in the CHMT membership. So that's a pretty considerable group that should count for something.
It's the size of Cornwall, like, exactly. You know, everybody knows that city. Yeah.
Those 185 co-ops get membership services from us, like any other membership organization. But in addition to that, we have, back in the 80s and 90s, when co-op development was supported federally and it was a much more active initiative to get more co-ops built, the organization I work for, I was not there, but they decided to use a land trust model where the land is owned by a land trust, which we administer, and the co-op functions on that with a lease agreement with us. So we have 32 co-ops that are occupying lands that the CHFT land trusts own. And the exciting point in history we're at now, I think, is that for many of those co-ops, we're getting close to the end of their original mortgage, which means the way we structured those leases, in many cases, there's what we call post-mortgage rent. So we, as an organization, will start to receive money from them, which, with a view to reinvesting that in the co-op sector. And that might look like helping them borrow money on the strength of that, or helping them build new units, or in many cases, helping them refurbish housing stock that's 35 years old now. So it's an exciting opportunity. And I should say, even though that there has been no co-op development essentially since 93, CHFT has been able to get a few projects off the ground during that period with some creative thinking and arrangements with private sector developers and that sort of thing. And we're hoping to ramp that up a little bit more now that we seem poised to get a federal program again. CMHC did promise $1.5 billion for a new co-op housing program back in April of 2022. And we have yet to see the details of that program, but we're really confident they're going to come soon and it's going to really provide the basis for an exciting new phase of co-op development. And we're poised to help make that happen. And that may involve private sector partnerships of a variety of different kinds.
Let me do a quick background. So to keep going on this, 35 years ago, the federal government provided, among other things, a CMHC program for the mortgages on co-op housing, and they called them index-linked mortgages. And they're effectively mortgages that were linked to the Canada Price Index, or CPI. At a time when interest rates were 12, 15, 18%, these things were, you know, let's call it 100 basis points over the CPI, which is inflation. So they're really great, attractive interest rates. And they're a 35-year term, 35-year AM. These things were designed to be very beneficial for the co-ops after development for the long term. And that's how you're talking about your land trust kind of come into play. Unfortunately, of course, First National happens to be the administrator of many of these index-linked mortgages, which is how I kind of have a background understanding of this. And so what happened was, fast forward 25, 30 years, and now it's 2018 or whatever, and Canada Price Index is 5%, plus the spread at 6.5%, let's say, for these mortgages, and yet the prevailing market interest rates was 3% or whatever it may be. So these things ended up being a little bit more of a noose than the benefit that they intended to be. What we're finding and working with our co-op clients now at First National is that for 35 years, they've been paying this mortgage down and unfortunately have been very cash flow restricted as a result of this large mortgage payment they were making. And this freedom, all of a sudden, as the 35 years expire, they're no longer having to spend literally like 50%, 60% of their rent on paying a mortgage and barely getting by no CapEx and minimal R&M. So I'll throw it back to you, Celia, as I set the table. What are you kind of doing and working with your co-ops to refurbish, replenish, rebuild?
So yeah, all of the above. It's very much specific to the co-op. Some co-ops over the years have done a really great job of maintaining properties because they have really great management and really excellent boards. And others have been the victim of one or the other not being as great. So they maybe need a little bit more help on the refinancing to do refurbishment. Others are sitting on property where there is great potential for development. So one, for example, that we're working with in Mississauga has two buildings, low rises. I think there's, I'm guessing a little bit now, but I think there's about 300 units between two buildings, not huge. But the property itself has enormous development and potential. And so we're in talks. We signed an MOU with a nonprofit condominium developer, actually.
So what's MOU?
Memorandum of Understanding.
Okay.
To explore the feasibility of some kind of joint venture on that property. So it's that kind of thing that we as a land trust are keen to explore. We have another, this actually isn't an existing co-op. This is a pocket of land that the City of Toronto freed up through its Create TO program, Housing Now. It's out in Scarborough, which is a traditionally underserved suburb of Toronto, but it's extremely well located in terms of transit. And we're working with a private developer there in the due diligence phase, which thankfully they are financing, to explore the possibility of two 300 unit co-ops and then a condo as well, which would be another 300 units. So this is the kind of scale that we need to start thinking about in the co-op and nonprofit sector again, because unfortunately, the developments we've been involved in over the last 30 years have tended to be much more, you know, we're getting 12 units here in this condo, we're getting a small expansion to a co-op of 26 units. That kind of scale isn't really going to change the world, but we're ready to start doing things on a bigger scale, which is very exciting. We just need the stars to align a bit on policy and on getting access to finance, which is obviously our biggest problem, among a few problems, but that is the biggest one.
We're sitting here at the CAIC, and one of the topics that's kind of come up is this National Housing Accord that the Real PAC, which is our industry activist group, has partnered with other industry players, predominantly on the nonprofit side or on the tenant advocacy side, to produce this National Housing Accord, which has 10 recommendations, and I've just pulled it up. One of the recommendations is that we need to double our social housing stock to just meet OECD averages. And so I read the numbers. There's currently 655,000 social housing units in Canada. Just to get to the OECD average, we need to double that in the next 5 years. So just giving weight to build 650,000 units in 5 years is a lot just to even get, and I the numbers are here. Like the United Kingdom is at 16% of total number of unit in the universe. So it really is we're way behind where we need to be. Let's just be clear. The tenants that live in these units are the most deserving of that inexpensive rent, correct?
Everyone deserves homes. I don't want to say co-op members are more deserving than anyone else. There's a lot of people struggling in private sector housing as well. What I can tell you is that we have a small expansion of a co-op in the Riverdale area of Toronto, basically at Queen and Broadview. It was an existing co-op. We had a builder, it's a turnkey approach, build basically 26 new units, replacing 9 that we lost. So the net is only whatever that is. Oh, and then 5 are going to artists. There's 12 units for the actual market. We have a lottery system to allocate those units. So right now, we haven't done a ton of promotion, but we've done some. And people can apply to be in the lottery to get access maybe to one of those units. For 12 units, we have already over 4,000 people wanting, and we are 2 weeks away from the deadline still. So there is an enormous, enormous need for affordable housing.
I'm assuming that for the people applying, there's a financial qualifier in order to be
eligible. What are the criteria? How does that work? It's clearly not first come, first serve.
It's not first come, first serve. Yeah, there's financial requirements. And I'm sorry, I don't have the exact details on what those are in front of me. Some of the units are reserved for people who are working in the arts. And then there will be some information sessions where people will then decide, do I want to be part of a self-governed operation? Because obviously it's a little different from rental housing in the traditional sense. So that's another criteria, is you want to be part of a community that has some autonomy and so on. So yeah, I mean, it's not a pure lottery, but just the number of people is just so overwhelming to me. that there's that degree of need. And that's just a tiny example of what we're faced with in this country right now. Very uplifting, I know, gentlemen.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you need the stars to align. You know, one of the pieces you mentioned was financing. Are the stars, can you see them starting to align, that there could be a big dent put in that 750,000 units that Aaron highlighted?
So, you know, Adam, I'm an optimist. And I've been thinking the stars were aligning for a while now, because there's no secret that there's a housing crisis. And governments are all talking about how there's a housing crisis, but it's hard to continue that level of optimism when year after year, like even the federal government, and I know they put aside that big chunk of money, and I know they're working hard on a program for co-op housing development, but it's 16 months now since they announced it, and we still don't know what it looks like. So I hope the stars are aligning. But beyond money, I think we have some other problems in the sector, and I'm happy to talk about those as well. I think one that really comes to mind, and I am kind of hoping that having our private sector friends know about this problem might help us, is that because we have not done housing development in 35 years, we have a real knowledge gap in the sector. So the folks who know about the ILM program that you talked about, Aaron, and the programs that preceded it, they're either dead or retired. And I mean, I was kind of shocked that you knew about it, because you're younger than I am. And usually I'm the youngest in the room who knows anything about this stuff. And the only reason I know about it is because I've been told. So this is an issue. And I found this when I was working as a lawyer serving the sector, because we did not have high billing rates, and we couldn't have high billing rates because our clients couldn't afford to pay them. We also then couldn't afford to pay our lawyers who were coming out of law school wanting to do this kind of housing development in the nonprofit sector. They couldn't afford to pay off their student debt and buy the houses that they felt they were entitled to, and they should be. And so we don't have developers who want to work in this sector who have knowledge. You know, there's a whole bunch of adjacent professionals who would need to feel committed to doing this kind of work and possibly earning less. I think that's the challenge that we as a housing sector broadly have to face. And I hope that folks listening to this will think about how they might contribute in some way to filling that knowledge gap.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't think of anything great to follow that up with, other than the 12 units here and there is just not going to cut it. Even if they commit, you know, I'm building 30 stories, you can have five, you know, there's another 40 units.
Don't stop doing it, but
you need multiple towers of hundreds of units over and over and over and over again, right? It's not going to be done by the tens and twenties of units here and there, which are helpful, of course, but not to the same extent. I mean, and obviously we're going to need that CMHC money to come up with some very creative ways to motivate the private sector to help. Clearly they're not going to ask you to build it. They're going to build it and give it back to you and find ways to make that work.
Adjusting the pay scales is the obvious one,
but we need folks who understand the language on our side to help in that process, right? So, you know, that's where the knowledge gap, I think, lies. You're right. We're not going to be doing the development, but we need to understand what's going on. And we don't have a cadre of people coming forward who understand that.
That's complicated. My involvement throughout the years working at First National, because we happen to be the administrator of so many of these index-linked mortgages, and now are managing these loans that are maturing and working with the co-ops that have, or the federations that manage the co-ops that need some significant TLC in the assets. And I'll tell you, fair, like CMHC has been a great partner to develop new programs to help with, you know, reserves and CapEx programs to reinvest and fix interest rates quickly. And there's lots of great programs that the federal government, like, this is not a program or this is not a segment of the housing community that people are ignorant to. I think it's just really complicated.
Yeah, I agree.
Not to continue a parade of negativity, but you mentioned aging in place as being another issue that the co-op world is grappling.
I think it's a very big issue. So many of these co-ops that were developed 30 plus years ago are still populated by original members, because that's what the co-op model encourages, is community that stands. It's not, I won't call it a family, that's a bit corny, but it's a real community. And so it's not seen as a stepping stone up the housing ladder. It's seen as a destination. And so what that means is many of those now occupants who've been there a long time are rattling around in three-bedroom townhouses by themselves, and they don't want to move out to a condominium or a rental unit somewhere else that might be more appropriately sized, because this is their home and this is their community. But if we could roll back the clock 30 years, we might actually build communities that have a range of different sized units to accommodate this eventuality. But that didn't happen in a lot of cases. So one of the exciting things that I've been doing in my job at CHFT is interviewing people who've made big contributions to the housing sector, the co-op housing sector, over the last 50 years. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary next year, so we want to unveil these profiles. And so I had a really fascinating interview with a woman who moved into a housing co-op in Markham 35 years ago. And she was a single mom. She brought her two kids in, who I think were like 4 and 6 or something, and raised her family there. And when she no longer needed a 3-bedroom townhouse, she moved into a 2-bedroom unit in a mid-rise that's in the same co-op complex. And then when her second kid left, she moved into a 1-bedroom. And then one of her kids came back, because that's what kids do. And so she got a 2-bedroom again. And now she's back in a 3-bedroom with her son and his family. And he's becoming a member of the co-op. And it's a really great story about how it should work and how people need to make responsible decisions about the size of the unit they need. Because, I mean, frankly, these were developed with public money. And so this is part of the public realm in a way. But if you have to leave your community to achieve that, then I can see why so many people are reluctant to do that. And then, of course, there is the problem of the physical space not being very conducive to aging in place as well. When you've got a 3-bedroom townhouse, you're inevitably looking at least one flight of stairs. And then there's all sorts of accessibility issues that come from the aging housing stock anyway, because we weren't building with accessibility standards in mind. So this is a really critical issue for the co-op housing sector. CHFT has just started reignited interest around having an aging in place committee. I know the National Federation has its aging in place network to try to grapple with some of the issues around overhousing and also accessibility related to the physical unit. And also then, of course, there's supports necessary for people who are experiencing dementia, age-related dementia. So it's quite another hugely complicated aspect of the co-op world that we're trying to find some solutions to as we try to build more housing for other folks.
I can literally feel the overwhelm as we're talking about it. When your brain kind of wraps itself around it, it's
shucks. What's the National Federation?
The National Federation is called the Cooperative Housing Federation of Canada, and it's headquartered in Ottawa, but it has quite a large office here in Toronto as well. We have close relationship with it, as well as some other regional federations in Ontario and in BC. So it's a pretty close network among us all, and we work closely together on policy approaches and ways to address member needs and, you know, a wide range of coordination among all the federations.
Sure, yeah, because you need to work kind of in tandem across the country. We're almost out of time, Celia. So maybe last question is just about what's the next sort of 12, 24 months look like, and what are the big initiatives you've got on the go?
For me at CHFT, I was brought in to a new position. And so it's been very exciting for me to take all of my background and try to figure out how I can best use my skills and experience in this role. And that, I think, in some ways will involve me helping with some of the organizational infrastructure that often nonprofits don't have the energy for, or maybe the experience to do. So I'm trying to find ways to upgrade our information management and all sexy things like that. But at the same time, and although development is not my background at all, pretty excited to be involved, at least development adjacent, let's say, in my role to help find ways for us to actually get more housing built for folks.
We're developer adjacent as well, being lenders. And it is exciting. You know, if I financed a project and you go look at it and it's coming out of the ground and becoming real, it's exciting. Even if you're not there with the hammer yourself working on it. Celia, we are out of time. I want to thank you, of course, for coming to share your part of the world, the real estate world, with us. I mean, we've not taken too many looks into co-op housing in the past. So it was an eye-opener. Obviously, a lot of issues to work through. I want to thank the Real Estate Forum for hosting us here today at the Canadian Apartment Investment Conference, Kingston Capital for sponsoring the video series, First National for powering the podcast, but most of all, our guest, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial, investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario License Number 10514 and 11252.